In a world of EMS podcasters, EMS Office Hours is the only live podcast bringing you the latest topics and opinions in EMS. Turn down your scanner and turn up your speakers as we join Jim Hoffman and Josh Knapp on their latest EMS podcasting journey.
Welcome to EMS Office Hours. I am Jim Hoffman. Thanks for joining me for another episode of the podcast. Be sure to check out iTunes. You can like and follow the show and review it at emsseo.com/iTunes. It'll take you right to the page. Of course, we love the reviews and the ratings. It really helps us boost us up in the Apple world. Today, I am joined by Dominic Wallenzak. I might just push that again, but Dominic, thanks for joining me. I really appreciate you coming on today.
No problem, Jim. I'm glad to be in your office here.
Well, what I'd like you to do, real quick, Dominic, if you can, I guess, say your name the right way. So I might have butchered it again. I'll also kind of just give the listeners a quick overview, where you're at in EMS and what you're about, so they kind of know where you're coming from.
Sure, no problem. My last name is Wallenzak, but it's a very commonly butchered. In fact, back in fifth grade, my middle school teacher actually mispronounced it the most epic fashion possible. Going off the class roster first day, he called me Walnutsack. And unfortunately, that name and variations of Wallenzak, Nutsack, or just Sack to my friends kind of followed me all throughout my middle school time. So it's not the worst way to mispronounce my name, but definitely wouldn't be the first time.
That's funny. I can imagine going through that over the years, having people mispronounce it like that. Dominic and I reached out to a bunch of EMS professionals online, trying to get them to come on the show and give some insights about stuff they're passionate about in the industry and try to, give different points of view and people out there that might not even be aware of some of the things that go on sort of behind the scenes, on the truck, educational-wise, stuff like that. I know you had mentioned in one of our comments going back and forth that you wanted to maybe talk a little bit about CC paramedics.
Yes, absolutely. So this is an area that actually became sort of a passion of mine. In fact, that's why I started the Crit Medic podcast. I was a longtime listener, a longtime fan of the MCRID podcast. Mm-hmm. At the time, there wasn't a lot of material in the EMS podcast world devoted to strictly EMS application of critical care concepts. So taking that CRIT part of MCRIT and also as an homage to the MCRIT podcast, I put CRIT and Medic together to bring together the aspects of pre-hospital care and in-facility care, meeting the critical care world. Because there's a lot of information, a lot of differences between the two. And I think that by going into the critical care realm, we can actually benefit all of our patient care.
Well, it's funny you say that. We had a guest on last week, the week before, and she's in paramedic school right now, and she's focusing on that element. She's very interested in that element of EMS. And my co-host Josh has been to critical care course back in the day before it became something even like it is today. I was doing critical care transports, and even from my personal perspective of it, I didn't really get too much more additional training other than how to kind of monitor the pumps and the machines and stuff like that. Whereas nowadays I feel like it's gotten much more in depth as to how, the different things that critical care medics need to be aware of.
Well, there's definitely been a drive towards improving our knowledge and professionalization of the field. And one of those aspects is we really need to have the solid foundation and knowledge base to do the things that we do. When I started off as a paramedic, brand new paramedic, first day, literal first day on the streets, actually first call that I ended up taking was what most people consider a critical care interfacility transfer. It was a vented septic patient who was on norepi and vasopressin, and they were running albumin and vanco and bicarb and saline. So they had all these pumps running. And so this was my first call on my own as a paramedic, just cleared. And our region didn't really have, and one could argue still to this day, doesn't really have a solid appreciation of the differences between standard EMS care and the extra skill set and knowledge base that's needed for these kinds of patients that we encounter on transfers. So that's why I went to do my critical care training in my neighboring region where I did my paramedic training initially, because they have a well-developed critical care system, and these kinds of transfers would be devoted to those people who took that additional training, have that extra knowledge basis.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I know when I first started in EMS, I was doing lots of volunteer stuff, you know, to get on the ambulance and to do kind of the emergency call. But then I started to work for the interfacility, you know, transport agencies. And, you know, people, I think when they first come into EMS, they want to get into the 911 aspect of it, right? They don't want to do the interfacility transports, you know, the GOMA runs that you hear them kind of call it, you know, sometimes. But I think that people can really learn a lot from that. And this is something too, I always say that, you know, we've got these different levels of paramedic, EMT, things like that. But I think that we need to really start really looking at things like the interfacility transport medics as not as a way to get your foot in the door in EMS, but as a whole nother level of, you know, it was inside the profession, that it shouldn't be, that should not be necessarily an entryway into EMS. You know, that should be a different sort of job all on its own, where maybe you should have some experience before getting into that. Because like you said, your first patient is a patient with all these drips and pumps going and stuff, and you're a brand new paramedic. You know, I know when I was doing that, and I ended up, one of my first interfacility transports doing the critical care stuff was a patient who was a, you know, post cardiac arrest patient, you know, and all I'm thinking the whole time is, oh my goodness, well, this person codes again, you know. I wasn't familiar with, you know, the drip rates that they had and some of the drugs they had going and the pumps and stuff like that. So I feel like this should be more of a push, I think, for people getting into that job to really have, like you said, that additional knowledge. You know, that additional training before they get there, not necessarily make it this sort of entry level, you know, door to get into EMS.
It's true. A lot of people, unfortunately, have a sort of EMS elitism to the 911 response, 911 medic aspect.
Right.
And to a certain extent, interfacility is looked down upon. Well, really, it's actually that the converse is true. In 911, in the past 6 months, I would say I've only had maybe a small handful of really critically ill patients versus in the, you know, infacility ICU to ICU transfer situation, you're dealing with patients that are not only too sick for EMS, they're too sick for the sending facility to manage, and you are the one that's responsible for conveying them and maintaining and improving their level of care to definitive care at a more tertiary facility.
Right.
And that's why it really takes a whole nother skill set. But beyond just, you know, needing your critical care for these interfacility transfers, because not everyone aspires or is really interested in hospital-to-hospital jobs, I think critical care not only made me better at interfacility calls, but getting my critical care also made me a better street paramedic as well.
Yeah, and that's something that we were talking to the last guest we had on, and she was kind of mentioning the same thing, how that sort of training and her additional schooling that she's had, he's kind of been able to kind of recognize things that are going on the calls when she's doing her rotations and things that maybe she might not have had she just done the basic, you know, 911, just kind of doing what she has to do to get out onto the ambulance and not necessarily that additional training, you know. And like you said, there is, I think, an elitist thing for people thinking that 911 is the way, you know, to go. But I think that, with, like you said, the critical care aspect of it does make you think a little deeper onto what is going on with your patients. And like you said, nowadays in 911, you're not getting, I mean, I even for myself, I know, you know, I used to get a lot of 911 calls where it was all, I had a lot of critical patients, and I'm finding more and more it's not necessarily that. Like you said, it's more of a handful of patients that are requiring a lot of the advanced things that I can do for them as a paramedic running the 911 calls. You know, whereas when you're doing the critical care stuff, you are pretty much all the calls you're doing, especially if you're at the paramedic level, that you're preparing yourself to take care of these patients that, like you said, the sending hospital isn't prepared or equipped to take care of the patient, and you're taking it to, you know, a more equipped facility. You know, one thing I'd like to ask you, Dominic, is one thing that I do see is that I don't feel, maybe it's different, but I don't think there's like a standard of who is doing these interfacility transports. A lot of places I see where you'll get, you know, one place I know where you've got a paramedic and two nurses, or a paramedic, a nurse, and a respiratory therapist, and the nurse and the two nurses or the therapist are pretty much doing the patient care, the documentation, the evaluations, they're getting their reports, giving the reports, and the paramedic ends up being reduced to the driver, the person restocking things, the lifting, you know, stuff like that. And where other places, the critical care is where you've got two paramedics doing it, or even one paramedic, one EMT, where the EMT is the driver and the equipment person and stuff like that. And I'm wondering what your take is on that, why you think, you know, you've got different ways and different areas kind of approaching that instead of just having it where they're focusing on the medics doing it.
Well, I think different areas have a different appreciation for the seriousness and the complexities involving the interfacility transfers. As a perfect example, my region has no real set criteria for who can take these interfacility transfers as a paramedic. You have to take a one-hour in-service course, and it's just an overview of basic interfacility concepts and some of the protocol considerations. But it's really not an in-depth training, and it's pretty much open to every paramedic. So pretty much every paramedic we have, you know, takes all these vent transfers and takes all these, you know, vasoactive medications. Versus in the neighboring region, they actually have a well-developed SCT program where, you know, you go through stages. You can go and get your vent credential, where you're credentialed on how to not only set up the vent, but considerations for how to titrate and make adjustments as your patient changes. Currently, our procedure here is in our area, well, you just copy what the vent is at the sending facility and, well, hope for the best.
Yeah.
But is that the best approach for our patients? I would posit no, it's really a bad idea. 2/3 of my patients don't need any vent adjustments. But for the 1/3 that needs some sort of adjustment, whether it's small or big changes, there's no substitute for having a well-trained and knowledgeable provider to be able to make those changes on the fly as necessary.
Yeah, and even when you think about some of the equipment issues, I know even from, you know, the when you talk about vents and pumps and things like that, the ones you have in the ambulance might not be the same as a facility that you're sending it from. And I know I used to have to change over the drips to, you know, my machine, you know, so sometimes, like you said, it's not just about copying what you see on another machine. It's, you know, adapting it to how your machine is running. It's knowing how to set up that machine, knowing how to run the numbers, to get that going. And like you said, a way to even manage it in route, because, you know, I know there were times where I would take a machine from the sending hospital with me to the receiving hospital, and I knew nothing about how that machine works. And, you know, and I don't know about you, but a lot of times when you get those machines, for some reason, when you get in the back of an ambulance, they want to start letting the bells go off, and you don't have no idea why bells are suddenly going off when they were fine in the hospital and there were no changes made since you've taken the patient away. You know what I mean?
And
I think knowing how to use the machines, knowing what the values are, and knowing what the settings should be, as a provider, or even as if there's a family member with you in the back of the ambulance and things like that, that you don't have that additional stress added to you, that you don't know what the hell is going on or why these bells are going off. You know, it could just be a simple malfunction of something, or it could be something more serious going on. And I think knowing, you know, how to handle it, why it might be happening, things like that, is very important. I think, like you said, having that additional training is vital. It's great that you said that you know, that it's a short course. It doesn't make you a critical care medic, but it gives you that additional training to handle that stuff.
So I would also add that the changes and differences with critical care is that a lot of these patients aren't ones that are diagnosed, and you know, they have all the labs, they have all the information, they have all that you could possibly want as a provider to be able to treat these people. A lot of these really sick patients are patients that we actually encounter in the 911 setting. So the critical care training really translates well into the field, because you get these people, you get the calls over at the nursing home. How many times have you taken call, Jim, for, oh, you're going to such and such nursing home for the patient with abnormal labs?
Right.
And most of us are quick to poo-poo. They've been like, oh, whatever. They've probably had this abnormal lab for a while. You know, who cares? It's not a big deal. We'll just sling them on over to the hospital and that'll be that. But having that baseline training with additional critical care knowledge, a big component of that is understanding hematology, understanding what the labs mean and what their impact is on the patient's outcomes. So when we see those labs and we see that, oh, their abnormal lab is that their potassium is really high, or we see that their sodium is low, or whatever particular derangement they have, we can appreciate what's going on with the patient and understand, like in a DKA patient, these are patients that may unfortunately ultimately need intubation based on just their clinical presentation and expected clinical course. You know, we have to know the difference that these patients shouldn't be ventilated to maintain a normal CO2 rate and a normal respiratory rate, because these patients are dependent on that respiratory alkalosis to offset the metabolic acidosis. And trying to do what typically everyone considers as normal in the 911 setting of a normal CO2 level might actually be detrimental and harmful to the patient.
Yeah, it's you know, that's one of the things that I guess personally I'm kind of on the line with that. What I see a lot in Facebook forums and Facebook groups and stuff where they'll have a scenario, you know, someone come with a scenario about something, and then you'll have somebody, you know, come in with what are the lab values, you know. And I'm always like, you know, all right, give me a break with that. You know, just don't try to show how smart you are in the group. Let's stick with the basics of what the scenario is asking. But on the other hand, I do get where you're coming from, where that when you know certain lab values, it can lead you to kind of understand what you might be seeing with that patient, even on an EKG, where certain lab values might change the way an EKG is presenting to you. Or the way the patient is breathing, or the way their mental state might be, you know, and knowing lab values, maybe not getting too deep into it, but knowing a lot of the basic values might really lend you to understand what you might be seeing with that patient, you know. And I'm not sure that maybe some people getting too deep into it without looking to be a critical care medic, you know, just doing the 911 stuff. Or they're not getting into it enough where they can understand why it might be important to know some of that stuff.
Well, there's definitely a whole rabbit hole you can go down and explore with any aspect. I think the most traditional place you find paramedics tend to gravitate is lots of people love to go really in-depth into EKGs. It was one of the first original labs, if you will, or additional diagnostic measures that EMS was really able to embrace in the field. And that's why a lot of EMS providers tend to gravitate towards EKG as an additional knowledge set, as an additional thing that they really like to excel at.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where labs are. It's another compliment. It's another addition that people can potentially really explore and really go in depth on if they are so inclined. Unfortunately, it's also one of those fields where 90% of agencies, if not more, don't really have a good method for measuring that in the field. iStats are fairly expensive, and the cartridges are disposable and, you know, pricey. So you're not being reimbursed for that. So we don't often have access to, you know, instant point of care labs in the field.
Right.
So sometimes you can argue that what is the utility of this information and what is the availability going to be of such information?
Yeah, it comes down to, I guess, the money end of it, you know, agencies spending money for it, you know, or training staff in it, where it's going to benefit what it is that they're actually, you know, doing out there, you know. And even you think about things like even like with sepsis and stuff and you know, testing patients, you know, for sepsis, you know, doing those blood tests in the field. And those machines, you know, to do the blood tests are right now, they're kind of expensive. So a lot of agencies aren't doing it yet. There is a big push towards really addressing sepsis in the field you know, and starting some type of treatment in the field and recognizing it, you know, so when you get to the hospital, they're kind of aware that this is what your working diagnosis is for that patient, you know. And I think that eventually we're going to get to that where we're using those monitors to do a blood test for sepsis. And it might be down the road where it goes into things, like you said, maybe some basic lab values for stuff, especially when you talk about, you know, cardiac patients, stuff like that, you know.
Much more valuable
than people are actually seeing. But of course, like I said, you got to kind of, I guess, you know, see where the money end of it is going to be for agencies, you know, because that's where they run off of. No matter how much we as providers want to do more, want to see more, want to learn more, you know, the agencies that are paying are the ones that are end up being the kind of driving force, you know, what we do with that information once we have it.
You know, absolutely. That's definitely a big consideration. Unfortunately, EMS is a business, even if it's fire-based or municipal. There's always a bottom line. There's not a never-ending font of money that we can continue to extract from. So sometimes it's a matter of picking and choosing what our battles are, what makes the best bang for our buck as far as patient outcomes and clinical care. And I'll argue that not a lot of the markers that we use in sepsis really have that great utility in the field. Like knowing, you know, what your percentage of bands and segs are as far as your white blood cell breakdown to evaluate where they've got, a shift in one indicating potential early sepsis. I would say that that doesn't really have a lot of applicability from all the critical care concepts you can learn. The most important thing would be to the understand of the what and the why. What's happening to your patient as far as their capillary permeability. Why is fluid resuscitation potentially an indicated treatment? You can argue left and right based on, you know, Rivers' study, whether it was, you know, reproducible or not. But anyways, without going into a tangent about that, you can always apply these concepts to understand what's going on inside your patient. So it's not only about doing things to the patient. I know in EMS, we like to focus on what can we do? How's it going to change what we do? And a lot of what we learn doesn't so much impact what we do. It impacts how we approach the problem and what our clinical judgment is as far as rendering treatment and care.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, that's something I'm always kind of pushing people, and you see so many people that are just trying to go to school and they study to pass the test and to get into, you know, into the job, and then their level of education after that, whether it's, you know, college or otherwise, is based on getting required continuing education credits that they can apply to a recertification rather than trying to, you know, seek out knowledge and build their knowledge based on, you know, how they can be better providers. Like you said, making better clinical decisions, identifying what might be going on with the patient and recognizing why they should be doing something or why they shouldn't be doing something, you know, for a patient, you know, based on knowledge that they're learning, not necessarily, like you said, learning it, you know, just to be able to do something. You know, people go to, you know, airway courses, or they go to EKG courses with this mentality that, well, I can do something with that information. But sometimes, you know, it can benefit you to sit there and read about a certain disease process that might be common that we see in EMS so that you can recognize it quicker, you can identify it, and know what's best for the patient as far as what you can do, can't do, or even the facility that you end up transporting them to. You know, so I always push for, you know, trying to move the knowledge needle just a little bit, you know, and I think a lot of people, when they start doing that, I think they're going to find they don't know as much as they think they do. And the people that enjoy it are going to end up realizing that there's so much that they can learn that they'll actually enjoy doing it. And, you know, by moving that knowledge, you know, to taking small increments and pushing to be that better clinician.
And absolutely. There's the other half of the equation as well. Part of it is learning when to do something. But the other half is knowing when not to do something that you could do, but it comes down to a question of whether it's something that you should do,
Right.
Just because you can doesn't mean you should. And sometimes, lots of times, in fact, discretion is, you know, the better point of valor.
Yeah, I see a lot of you do see a lot of people out there that will push a drug or something because in a protocol and the patient kind of fits into the protocol, and they just do it because they can rather than doing it because they should be doing it or because the patient absolutely needs it, you know, rather than thinking it through, you know. And I'm lucky where, you know, my medical director uses the protocols as a guideline. And then if you do something or don't do something, you know, the mindset, if you can back it up of why you did something, why you didn't do something, they'll stand behind you, you know. And that goes back to, you know, having that knowledge and, you know, being able to recognize things so that you can defend what you're doing. You know, defending what you're doing by saying what was in a protocol isn't really that much of a defense. You know, you're better off defending it by, you know, knowing why you did it, you know, from a clinical, more of a clinical type perspective.
Absolutely. And that's something. Ow. Sorry, I just dropped a book in my foot. That was unexpected. So absolutely. That's, you know, definitely a valid point. Just give me a second here. Oh boy. Oh man. I just lost my train of thought. Talk about a huge derailment on that one.
That's all right. I was just mentioning about, you know, being able to understand what you're doing for a patient beyond just following a step-by-step, you know, protocol. Understanding why you're doing it, why you're not doing it, and being able to back it up, you know, with the knowledge that you have, not using the fact that it was in the book, it was in the protocol, and that's why I did it.
Indeed. I mean, I use it all the time, even for my regular care. I tend to try and justify in my narrative my clinical rationale for why I did this treatment or did that treatment, or, as importantly, why I could have done this treatment, but why I decided that wasn't optimal at this point.
Right.
It's not only, you know, good patient care, it also helps to explain to your, you know, CQI person, you know, what were you thinking? Which could be, you know, both, you know, a good and bad consideration, right?
Right.
So what I was thinking is this, and it's also additional benefit to the company as far as, you know, justifying, you know, insurance reimbursement and rates. You know, why did you do these three medications that bumped it up to an ALS tier 2 call? You know, were these justified medications? Was this a justified approach? And you can justify your clinical rationale, you know, right there in the narrative. And having that additional knowledge base behind the why aspect of it really helps to bring that out.
Well, let me ask you this. I want to try to wrap it up, Dominic, but I think you make a good point there, and I just want to kind of ask just one last question. When it comes to the critical care training, do you find that you're able to document more effectively, and then in turn, do you find that the you know, the QAQI people that read it appreciate that you're able to document more effectively because of that, or do they seem, you know, I guess more confused or perplexed of the additional documentation, you know, as far as billing and things like that go? You know, you think it's helped and, you know, with that additional education, and is it helping the, I guess, management end of it, you know, like you said, with billing and stuff like that?
I think it helps in multiple ways. I think that having critical care knowledge impacts the patient and benefits them down the line, say in the hospital course and the ICU course of treatment, because my pre-hospital documentation and knowledge, all of my pertinent negatives and all of my information that I gather with an eye of what are some of the things that they may want to know later on the field from the field in the hospital that they may not have access to. What are some of the indications that I saw? What are some of the signs and symptoms that I saw on scene that a critical care intensivist may want to know that other providers may dismiss and not include it in their documentation thinking it's not pertinent?
Right.
I think that's one way that we can benefit. As far as the question about whether it benefits CQI, well, I mean, that's a varied bag depending on obviously who's doing it at your agency. you know, I think that being able to explain your rationale might prevent some additional interaction with CQI, because you can explain why you did it. And they can say, oh, well, I don't need to bother Dominic because he spelled it out right here. Either that, or it maybe just confuses the CQI personnel doing the auditing and they just decide not to ask any questions. Either way, it results in less hassle for me. So I mean, that's sort of a net benefit.
Right, right. Well, listen, Dom, I loved having you on today, man. I think that the critical care end of EMS, I think, is growing. And I think I'm seeing a lot more people interested in it. I don't know if that's because they're looking at it as a future of EMS, or if they're looking at it as a way to, you know, a lot of people I see do stuff like that because they're looking at it as a way to get faster into a management position and get off the ambulance. And I think a lot of people are doing it, though, from what I see, I think most of the people that are doing it, like the guest I had last week, is they're doing it because they want to have more knowledge and they see the benefit, you know, of having that additional knowledge, you know, and being able to apply it in the field. You know, and it might be you go through that type of training and you've got that additional training and maybe, you know, you're fine, you're not using it all that much because you're doing a lot of, you know, grandma fell out of bed or the trip and fall at the nursing facility, stuff like that. But I think that more often than not, you're going to, I think, find a use for it, you know, and I think you're going to find where you can apply that training and that knowledge, you know, and going, like you said, going beyond skilled, it's actually applying that knowledge.
You got it, Jim. Paramedic is an entry-level certification to the field of paramedicine. Where you go from there, whether you stay at that entry level and just do the repetitive medical education to stay at that entry level, or whether you choose to apply yourself and really get involved and passionate about your profession and advance yourself as far as you can as a provider, I think there's room in this profession for those who want to excel to be able to do more. And critical care may be one of those pathways that, you know, might be most beneficial to people to gain that additional knowledge and that additional training.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, Dominic, I'm going to end it there, man. I really appreciate you coming on. I enjoyed having you on. Hopefully get you on here again and talk more about some other EMS topics that you're passionate about. Before we run, anything you want to mention to the listeners where they can find you as far as social media or websites, anything like that?
Well, I do the critical care focused Critmedic podcast. Actually, now I would consider more of a vodcast. You can find me mostly on Facebook. I put them out on Twitter as well, and I've been cross posting it through EMS World as well. I'm a little bit dormant at the moment. I sort of bored myself by going in depth into cardiology, and even though that's a real interest of mine, I think just the going through all the steps of it just sort of bored me. So I had to take a break, had to step back for a little while, but I plan on getting back into it this fall. And hopefully I'll catch you all in the podcast, vodcast world.
All right. Well, I'll go ahead and put a link to the website so they can look at some of the, listen to some of the older episodes and articles and stuff you have there, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
All right. All right. So that's it, guys. Again, thanks, Dominic, for joining. Guys, if you have questions, comments, be sure to post them in the show notes. DM me on Instagram or Facebook, Twitter. I'm at EMS Safe on Instagram and Twitter. You can follow the Facebook page at facebook.com/EMS professional. And I'm sure you'll see me floating around in a bunch of EMS groups as well. So if you want to ever, you know, hit me up or contact me, DM me. I would love engaging with listeners to the show. And again, if you guys want to have a guest on or questions you want us to address on the show, be sure to send them over to me. It's contact@EMSOfficeHours.com. All right, that is it, guys. As always, I am Jim Hoffman for EMS Office Hours. Stay safe.